and you kind of look at who this God really is, and yet we come before him sometimes, you know, maybe flippantly, if we were to be real honest, and yet we look at who this God is, and we can't help but be floored. And I mean that in the literal sense, where just we come before him. We find in Revelation, John, when he comes to understand who this God is that's giving him this revelation, he falls on his face as though he were dead when he comes to that realization. We see Isaiah, when he comes face to face with who this God is in Isaiah chapter 6, he says, woe is me, for he recognizes his sin. He says, I'm a man of unclean lips. And he recognizes who he is, and he falls down, and he worships this God. We've been talking through some of the Old Testament, particularly in Genesis, and we've talked about how these patriarchs, these ancient people of Israel, and how God had selected his nation, how he had developed it, how he had built it up. You know, we went back to the very beginning. We looked at how God had created things. We certainly spent some time talking about Abraham and how God had, through Abraham, built up this covenant, this promise in this man of Abraham, and how God had called him, or the scriptures call Abraham, as being a man of faith. He had great faith, but yet we look at that deeper and we understand where that faith came from or why he could have such faith, and it was because God was faithful through that. We talked about how this personal God, how he breathed life into his creation, how he interacted with his creation, how he is that personal, and that kind of a connection. We're going to see some of that happen again this morning as we continue to move forward this morning in the story of Moses. And then we see how God took that promise that he had given to Abraham, and he carries it through Isaac, he carries it through Jacob, and then we see it build up into the life of Joseph, which we dealt with last week. Fascinating story of Joseph and how basically for 13 years worth he is persecuted in a way. And yet at the coming the end of it, he is in Egypt. And we find that while he is in Egypt, God has, in a sense, built him up, spared him, and he uses this experience for his bigger purpose, his bigger good. We talked about how we sometimes will look at our lives and how we feel like, well, this is just not right, this is not fair, this is not just. And until we can zoom out, we look at that cell, that small thing, and how it functions and how it works, and we can't see the bigger picture. But then sometimes once we can actually zoom out and see how that cell functions and works with the rest of the body, oh, wait, that makes sense. And we saw that with Joseph's story last week, and how you look at it from the narrow perspective. He was beaten, he was sold, he was in slavery, he was imprisoned, and over again, you see how things didn't work out very well for him, and yet God was with him, and you pull back, and you look at the bigger picture, and you see what God does. And we talked about that promise that God had made to Abraham back in Genesis chapter 15. And so we had this slide up last week. We're just going to show it again here. Remember what God had said to Abraham. So Abraham was doubting. Remember, he had promised the son, the great nation, and Abraham, it says in Abraham 15, verse 6, it says, Abraham believed. That was verse 6. And then in verse 8, two verses later, it says, but Abraham said, how am I going to know that this is going to happen? So it was fascinating. We have this belief piece that kind of slides in there, and he backs off and says, but how can I know? What can I be assured of? And this is the answer that God gave him. Abraham fell asleep, and he was given this vision while he was sleeping. And this is what I want you guys to catch and to know and to see. And we talked again about it last week because we led right up to the doorstep. And now we're going to step through the door, and we're going to look at, see what happens here. And it says here, Abraham fell into a deep sleep, but this part right here in particular. Do I have a list? There's my laser. Know for certain that for 400 years, your descendants will be strangers in a country not their own, and that they will be enslaved and mistreated there. But I will punish the nation that they serve as slaves, and afterward they will come out with great possessions. You, however, will go to your ancestors in peace. This is to Abraham. And be buried at a good old age. In the fourth generation, your descendants will come back here, for the sin of the Amorites has not yet reached its full measure. And so there's the promise that we have there that basically saying to Abraham, this is what's going to happen. I'm going to give you this land, but you got to understand there's going to be a sequence that happens. And one of those things that happens is your family, your offspring, this great nation that you're going to be built up, is going to be in slavery for 400 years. And that's what we're going to step into, and we're going to see that this morning. So we left off with Joseph. And we saw that Joseph had revealed to his brothers, he said, what you guys meant to be nasty and mean, which was incidentally nasty and mean, God took it and used it for something that was really good. And then what happens is Jacob, their father, eventually dies. So you remember what happened. We have Joseph, his brothers come, they visit. It's okay, guys. You know, that God, you intended it for evil, God made it for good. And so then he goes to Pharaoh and he says, Pharaoh, here's the thing. I just learned my family's here. You know, and Pharaoh says, wow, how about that? This is wonderful. Why don't you invite your family? Because this is during that great famine. 2 years into it, in total of 7 years. So they got 5 years left of this famine. Without Egypt stepping into this situation, Israel and his family would have been in peril. Okay? So basically, Pharaoh says to Joseph, bring your family over. You know, they can come and live in Egypt. Egypt at this time in history, if you've studied ancient Egypt, it is absolutely mind-blowing. It is so fascinating because this is thousands of years BC. This culture was so functional. I mean, just beyond understanding. It is believed that the pyramids were built before the Israelites came onto the scene. You know, it's believed that that happened before. So some people believe that the Israelites were the slave labor that made the pyramids. Most historians believe that that is not the case, that this actually took place before the Israelites were enslaved for 400 years. But what that means then is like 2400 BC, these pyramids were being built. And it is said that the Great Pyramid of Giza was built in 23 years. We can't even get a football stadium built in 23 years, right? But it was fascinating. So some of the statistics. So in order for that to happen, this 23 years built on this pyramid basically meant that one of these great big stones that's bigger than this, okay? I don't know how big, it's big. One of these stones would have had to have been set every 2.5 minutes over and over again. I mean, and just the functionality, the efficiency that this culture is living under is just remarkable. And so it gives you a little idea. So you have this culture that's just way more evolved than people would, I don't like to use the word, but I just did, way more evolved in this concept of what an ancient culture should be like, and they're just super efficient and focused. And what we have then is we have Joseph who's bringing in his family, and basically Joseph gives his family a word of caution if we read the scriptures. And what he says is, you guys got to understand something. You guys are coming into Egypt. This isn't Canaan anymore. In other words, Canaan was fairly primitive, really. You're coming into Egypt. This is a highly civilized nation. You got to know something. They're going to ask you what your occupation is. This is a key question. They're going to ask you, what is your job? What is it that you do? Because what Egypt wants to do is they want to take you, find out what you're good at, where you're gifted, and you will be put into that part of its society so that you can function at its greatest efficiency. Make sense? You know, it's like, wow, that's really sweet. So Joseph gives a word of caution to Jacob and his family, says, you guys have to be shepherds, okay? You got to be livestock people. Care for the livestock. And there was a reason behind this. This is amazing when you think of it, because what it is then is, so they come in, and the Egyptians, all right, what is your job? And he said, we are shepherds, okay? The Egyptians wouldn't associate, they wouldn't interact, they left the shepherds alone. They needed them. But that was one part of it where there was had to be this separation, okay? They wouldn't, oh, well, here, come live with us. Oh, you're shepherds. You go out and you live elsewhere. And the beautiful thing about it is when that's the case, I shared this graphic a few weeks ago. So here was Abraham. He comes down here. This is Canaan. And he comes down now. And so Jacob was living here. This is Egypt. And this is where Joseph was. And they call for them to come in. Well, up to the north here, this is the most fertile area. This is where it's greenest. This is the Nile River Delta. It's green, it's flourishing, and this is where a lot of the livestock would have been grazing and such. So basically, and then Cairo would have been down into this area here, farther to the south. So by doing this, what ends up happening is you have God's people come in, and Pharaoh basically says, oh, you're shepherds? You go live up in the land of Goshen, which is up in here, separated from the rest of, in a sense, of civilization, and they're basically left alone to grow, to flourish, and yet they're under Egypt's protection. You know, what kind of a God is this that thinks through all of these things where, all right, yeah, I'm going to not only deliver you in a way into your hands of your future enemy, But I'm going to use your enemy to protect you. I'm going to use your enemy to feed you. And here you are, and you're going to be in here, and you're going to flourish, and you're going to grow, and you're going to blossom. And that's exactly what happens for 400 years. It's a remarkable situation. It's a remarkable story when you look at some of the history and the timeline for it. And then what we happen is the Pharaoh finally gets wise, and things begin to change. And when things begin to change, what you have is you have Pharaoh suddenly realizing, we have an issue. We have an issue because we have these Israelites who have come into this land, and not only are they a family of a father and 12 sons any longer, now they are a great nation. And there's a problem with this, them growing this big, because now we feel threatened. Okay? I don't like the idea of being threatened, and so I want to curb that. I want to offset that. And so what Pharaoh does to start that curbing, well, we've got to do something. We're going to oppress them with slave labor. Two things, okay? Keep their spirits down, and also talk about the manpower we've got here. So this is a totally different Pharaoh 400 years later, and he has no idea who Joseph was. That's long been forgotten. Do you guys remember back 400 years? Yeah, me either. Mark? I know it, right? Anyway, so you can't remember back that long. You know, so Pharaoh, even in their history, has forgotten it, you know? And so we have this new Pharaoh that steps into the scene. It's like, all right, I have slave labor at my ready. We're putting them to work. And so they put them to work to build these bricks, basically. That was their job, is they're making bricks. Have you ever made bricks? Anyone? And some of our mission trips, we've had to make bricks. And if you ever watch The Amazing Race on television, they oftentimes have to make bricks. It's kind of funny because your bricks are never good. It doesn't make any difference. You go across cultural, they show you how to make bricks. You think you're going to be helping, and pretty much they just step on your bricks. Your bricks are bad. Your bricks are bad. Your bricks are bad. It's a reality. So I don't know what kind of help we're actually offering. We went and learned how not to make bricks is really what it ended up being. But so you see it. So the Israelites then are making these bricks. And in this process, what you find is this man named Moses comes onto the scene. And in addition to the oppression, Pharaoh's got another plan by which to set aside so that these Israelites don't grow anymore. And what's it going to be? Well, it's going to be crowd control. All right? So he sends out the order to the midwives who are basically helping with the delivery of the babies. And he says to the midwives, any baby boy that is born shall be killed right off the get-go. And the Israelite midwives feared God and were not willing to do that. And they said, sorry. You know, basically they didn't say it. They just wouldn't do it. And they said, oh, these Israelite women are so hardy that they're delivering before we even get a chance to get there. Okay? So these baby boys are continuing to be born. And Pharaoh's not okay with that. You know? Yes, maybe it'll make more slave labor. But there's a problem with that. Because with the men, they would have been the fighters. You know, the men would have been the leaders. That's cultural in that time. You eliminate the men. You eliminate the possibility for procreation, you eliminate the possibility for retaliation, you're limiting the number of warriors that Israel would have, and so it's very strategic. It's not surprising coming from Egypt because they were brilliant, they really were. And so Pharaoh says, that's it. Now, if you're not going to do it this way, you're going to take all those babies, you're going to throw them in the river. The Nile River must have just been constantly flowing with dead baby boys. You know, how hard is that to fathom? How hard is that to comprehend? And so they would flow upstream. The Nile flows north, would flow upstream. And so it comes to this time where this woman has a baby. And she sees this baby as an exceptional child. I don't know what made it that way. Maybe he had perfect ears. Okay? And she, instead of getting rid of the baby like she's been instructed, she holds on to it for about 3 months, is what the scriptures say, you know, protecting it. And when she felt like she couldn't hide the baby any longer, she takes it and she makes a basket. Her command is to what? Throw it in the river. She's going to do just that, but with a certain degree of protection. She's going to manipulate. Have you ever manipulated the rules? Well, kids do it all the time. You know, Sarah tells this story. I should have asked her first, but Sarah tells this story where she was like sent to her room. Well, they had with her siblings, and so they had an upstairs, and all the rooms were upstairs. It was a good sized house, and so what they would do is they would take things from their room because it's part of their room, and they would lay it out in the hallway. And so then they would walk on their bedding and whatever else you have, because technically I'm still in my room because I'm walking on the bedding. Seriously, I mean, talk about manipulative, you know. But that's kind of the idea here, where you're kind of like, I'm obeying the rule, but yet you're sliding a little bit. And that's what I think we see happening here with Moses in this basket, where how can a mom just willingly do that? So she's going to lay out whatever protection she can. She lays Moses in the basket. And then Miriam goes and sets it in the reeds, almost as if like, oh, the baby just got caught in the reeds. It's not going downstream. And here comes Pharaoh's daughter and discovers the baby and pulls it up out because she heard the baby crying and felt sorry for it. I remember when my children were young, I felt sorry for them crying for about 3 minutes. And then, you know, 3 a.m., crying for 3 hours is not sympathizing. I don't like it. It's very difficult. And so I got over that sympathy part of it real quick. So I'm guessing that Pharaoh's daughter probably just came on the crying baby at the time, and Moses hadn't been crying for hours upon hours. Don't know that. I made that part up. But anyway, we move on, and we see then how God works again. And we see how Pharaoh's daughter sees the baby, takes sympathy on this. This is the deliverer. Baby doesn't know it. Pharaoh's daughter doesn't know it, but God knows it. And so he takes the baby and realizes, well, I need someone to care for this baby. She recognizes it right away as a Hebrew. She wouldn't have been stupid to realize it was Egyptian. She knew right away, this is a Hebrew baby. She gets Miriam, who happens to be standing at a distance, Moses' sister, watching. And so she gives the baby to Miriam. Miriam, it doesn't know her by name, and said, will you find someone to nurse this? And Miriam says, yes. Takes it back to Moses' mom. You know, the situation is different because now Moses is no longer his mom's property. Now Moses is the property of Pharaoh. There's a difference there. You know, so the dynamics have changed, but yet you see God's hand in this and how God works these things out. What seemed like, you know, devastating is really being orchestrated. It's being structured. It's being controlled. It's being pulled in by this God who is over all things and above all things. And then we find evidence that in Exodus chapter 2, you know, some people see Moses that as he grew older, he was surprised to find out that he was a Hebrew. I don't think that's the case. I think we see evidence there that talks contrary. In Exodus chapter 2, it specifies when Moses grew older, when he was with his mom, then he was given back to Pharaoh. I think that age thing there would have been something that like, okay, I'm Hebrew. But yet there's a property thing that existed between Pharaoh's daughter. You know, so I'm not buying that he was totally surprised by it. But then we also see in Exodus chapter 2, when Moses is an adult, he goes out into the Israel camp and watches them work in their slave labor. It says the words, he went to go watch his people. And so as he's watching his people work, he sees an Israelite being mistreated by an Egyptian. And he takes like, whoa, that's not right. And so he goes in and he attacks the Egyptian, kills the Egyptian, and it says, the scripture says, the very next day then, he is talking to two Israelites, or by two Israelites, and these two Israelites are fighting, conflicting with one another. One of them is wrong, and the other one is in the right, is what the scriptures say. And so he approaches the one that's in the wrong and says, why are you guys fighting amongst yourselves? You know, in other words, don't you see we're on the same team? I mean, you guys were being oppressed by the Egyptians, and then you guys are fighting amongst yourselves. You're fighting the wrong enemy, is really what Moses is getting at. And one of them responds to Moses and says, who made you ruler and judge over us? Very fascinating. In that word, in that scripture, in that word judge, it actually can be translated into be, who made you deliverer over us? And this is the time when Moses, at this point, he's just killed a man. He's confronted here. The Bible says he was afraid. We don't know specifically what his fear was. Was he afraid of Pharaoh? Maybe. Was he afraid of the Israelites that he just confronted? Maybe. But the reality is, look at it this way. You have a Hebrew who is not an Egyptian. He's been pulled away from his Hebrew family, and yet he's not fully Egyptian. Looking at the Israelites, is he accepted by the Israelites? No, he's just kind of pushed out to the side. Is he accepted by the Egyptians? No, he's somewhere in the middle. Not accepted really by either culture fully. He's just been shunned by the Israelites. And now you have Pharaoh who's trying to kill him. And so he flees and he goes into a land of Midian where he meets his wife. It was a good trip for him. So he goes into Midian and he meets his wife. 40 years go by. He has some children. He gets married to, well, he got married first. Then he had his children to Zipporah. And then we find that as he's out tending his flocks, his sheep, God does something amazing and he confronts him. And this is where we pick it up in Exodus chapter 3. It says, so now Moses was tending the flock of Jethro, his father-in-law, the priest of Midian. And he led the flock to the far side of the desert and came to Horeb, the mountain of God. There the angel of the Lord appeared to him in flames of fire from within a bush. Moses saw that though the bush was on fire, it did not burn up. So Moses thought, I will go over and see this strange sight, why the bush does not burn up. When the Lord saw that he had gone over to look, God called to him from within the bush and said, Moses, Moses. And Moses said, here I am. Do not come any closer, God said. Take off your sandals, for the place where you are standing is holy ground. Then he said, I am the God of your father, the God of Abraham, the God of Isaac, and the God of Jacob. At this, Moses hid his face because he was afraid. That's interesting. He just described who he was to Moses. Keep that in mind as we move forward. God has just said, I am that person. The Lord said, I have indeed seen the misery of my people in Egypt. I have heard them crying out because of their slave drivers, and I am concerned about their suffering. So I have come down to rescue them from the hand of the Egyptians and to bring them up out of the land into a good and spacious land, a land flowing with milk and honey, the home of the Canaanites. This is the same promise. Moses would have heard it in his, you know, Jewish history, I believe. Okay, I'm guessing at a very young age, even when he was at home, we don't know how old he was when he went back to Pharaoh's daughter. We don't know that. However, I do believe that we can be very confident that the Israelites would have been sharing this story of their ancestors, about how God had promised Abraham, how God had promised Isaac and Jacob and Joseph of this promised land. I think that would have been there and exposed to him. So I don't think this would have been a total, never heard that story before, to Moses. But notice the I statements. Who's doing the work? Who's going to be doing the work? And now the cry of the Israelites has reached me, and I have seen the way the Egyptians are oppressing them. So now go. This is the first sign of, okay, Moses actually has something to do. That's the first time. Okay? Now go. Everything else has been God saying, I am sending you to Pharaoh to bring my people, the Israelites, out of Egypt. But Moses said, who am I? Okay, it's a fair question, all right? Who am I that I should go to Pharaoh and bring the Israelites out of Egypt? And God said, I will be with you. Again, look at what God is doing. I am going to do this. I am going to redeem my people. I'm sending you to be my spokesperson, but I'm going to do this. And then he goes on and says, I will be with you. And this will be the sign to you that it is I who have sent you. When you have brought the people out of Egypt, you will worship God. You will worship me on this mountain. Moses said to God, suppose I go to the Israelites and say to them, this is who you just said you were. The God of your fathers has sent me to you. And they asked me, what is his name? What shall I say then? God said to Moses, I am who I am. And we hear that phrase, but how often do we actually take it and meditate on it and internalize it? I am who I am. This is what you are to say to the Israelites. I am sent me to you. God also said to Moses, say to the Israelites, the Lord, the God of your fathers. This, he already said this once. So he's repeating himself. Have you ever had to repeat yourself to your children? Never. Never. They listen the first time, every time. Say to the Israelites, the Lord, the God of your fathers, the God of Abraham, the God of Isaac, the God of Jacob, has sent me to you. This is my name forever, and the name by which I am to be remembered from generation to generation. Go, assemble the elders of Israel and say to them, the Lord, here it is again, the God of your fathers, the God of Abraham, the God of Isaac, the God of Jacob, appeared to me and said, I have watched over you 400 years. They haven't heard from God. They've heard the stories of God. 400 years, not all of it has been slavery, but in this time, remember we have this quiet period too. We talk about it between the Old and the New Testament. Again, it's about 400 years or so where God is, in a sense, silent. Well, we see a very similar thing happening here before God redeems his people out of Egypt. And yet God says, I have watched over you. They had no idea. But that doesn't diminish. If you don't know if God's there, it doesn't change the fact that God is there watching over you. You understand what I'm saying? Okay? Whether you feel it or whether you don't feel it, doesn't change the reality that God is watching over you. I have watched over you and have seen what has been done to you in Egypt. And I have promised to bring you up out of your misery in Egypt. Remember, he made this promise back in Genesis 15. We read about it. You're going to be there for 400 years. But when that time comes, I will punish those who have punished you. Okay? So I promised to bring you up out of your misery in Egypt into the land of the Canaanites, the land flowing with milk and honey. The elders of Israel will listen to you. And then you and the elders are to go to the king of Egypt and say to him, the Lord, the God of the Hebrews, has met with us. Let us take a 3-day journey into the desert to offer sacrifices to the Lord our God. But I know that the king of Egypt will not let you go unless a mighty hand compels him. So I will stretch out my hand and strike the Egyptians with all the wonders that I will perform among them. After that, he will let you go. Do you see the I statements that God is saying? Is this Moses' job? He's being sent, absolutely. Does he have a role to play? Absolutely. But who's doing the work? God is just laying it out, sir. Moses, understand this. I am going to do a great thing. I am going to fulfill my promise. I am going to take this land, these people out of Egypt, and I'm going to give them back the promised land that I have promised to them. Yep, it's been 400 years, but I told you that was going to happen too. Here it is. It's going to happen. I'm going to do this. And then Moses is, he struggles still. Well, how can I know this is true? Similar we saw with Abraham. God says, throw your staff down on the ground. So Moses obeys. He throws the staff down on the ground, turns into a snake. And he says, pick up your staff. I don't think so. There's a snake now. Have you ever picked up a snake? I hate snakes. I've never picked up a snake. I won't pick up a snake, especially one that has big pointy teeth, okay? And even if it does have big pointy teeth and it's one of those big ones that's thick and will crush you, I don't have any interest in picking that up either. I won't even pick up a garter snake. I don't know why it is. I will kill them, but I will not pick them up. Anyway, so he throws down his staff. It turns into a snake. And God says, pick up the snake. And he picks it up by the tail, and it turns back into the staff. You know, all right, you just saw this bush not burning. Now you've seen this kind of evidence of who this is. This is the same person that just told you to throw the staff down, just told you to basically what he's going to do in Egypt. I'm going to go, and I'm going to deliver my people. I'm going to do that. Right? And then he says, Moses, take your hand, put it into your coat. So he does that. He pulls it out, and his hand is covered with disease, with leprosy. I like the snake thing better, okay? Is this permanent? Okay, and then God says, put your hand back in there. He puts it back in there, and he pulls it out, and his hand has been restored. I love the picture there of how that hand is going to be restored, and the Israelites are going to be restored. Maybe I'm pulling too much into there. I don't know that I am, but even so, you see this restoration, and God's in this process of restoration. And then he also tells Abraham, you know, if you're before Pharaoh and you want some proof, take the water and pour it out onto the ground and you'll watch it turn to blood. Okay? I'm going to do this, Moses. I'm going to do this. Moses argues with him. He says, man, I can't talk. I've got this stuttering thing. And God replies to him, so here's the thing, Moses, I'll give you a helper. Someone who can speak will speak on your behalf. All right? You won't be alone. I've already told you I'm going to be with you. I'll give you Aaron as well. Finally, Moses says, God, please send someone else. And this is where God basically raises, I can see a parent raising his voice, stop it. You will go. I don't want to have anything else for arguments back at me. You will go. So Moses concedes. And God says to him, go, and I want you to show all of these signs to Pharaoh. I want you to let them see everything that it is that I'm going to do. And what's fascinating, and if we read into Exodus chapter 4, verses 21, 22, and 23, we would see basically what God's laying out. You're going to show him these signs. Pharaoh's going to say, I don't think so. And I want you to know he killed all these sons of Israel. I'm taking his firstborns as well. You know? Pharaoh, who thought he could get away with this idea of killing all of these Israelite boys, I'm going to do the same. And Pharaoh's going to see my power, and he's going to shudder. And so Moses goes. He goes before Pharaoh. He shows him and says, he gathers the elders from Israel. They go to Pharaoh and says, this is what the Lord, the God of the Hebrews, says. Let my people go. We want to go, and we want to worship God. Take a 3-day journey and worship God. Pharaoh's response in Exodus chapter 5, verse 2 is this. Who is the Lord that I should obey him and let Israel go? I do not know the Lord. and I will not let Israel go. Who is this God that you're talking about? It's fascinating. Egypt, you know, we talk about their culture. Pharaoh, they would have seen him. He would have presented himself as, and he would have believed that he is God. In that culture, Pharaoh was the supreme being. There was no one greater than Pharaoh. They did not recognize anyone greater than Pharaoh. So basically, when they go to Pharaoh and they say, all right, here's the thing. The God of the Hebrews, they want you to let us go. And Pharaoh says, who do you think this God is? Who do you think I am? This God has nothing on me. These are his words. He has nothing on me. I am the God of Egypt. Small I, small A, small M. In truth. But that's the whole mentality. But you know what? How many times do we do the same thing? Honestly, in our lives, how many times do I choose to be I am? Small I, small A, small M. And I live my life in such a way that I think I am the God of my universe. And I live my life in such a way that I think I am the God of my home and of my decisions. And what we're going to find then is Pharaoh gets angry. And he says, you want to know who I am? You think your God is something? Watch what I can do. And Pharaoh then says, I want you now to take these Israelites, and I want you to increase their workload, and we're not providing them any straw for the bricks. You know how my bricks fell apart? These bricks are going to fall apart if they don't have some straw. And they have to make the same number of bricks. And so what they have to do is they have to go and gather their own straw and bring it in to make these bricks even worth having. And the Israelites are oppressed, and they say, Moses, why have you done this to us? You know? They're all on board just a second ago. Even the elders, like, well, you basically, what they say then is say, what you have done, Moses, you brought in, you came in and you talked to us and you brought in this. Look at the curse that you have brought Pharaoh down on us. Okay, this is what Pharaoh's doing to us now. You know, you have made us a stench in the nose of Pharaoh, and so he's punishing us. And yet you still have God, what he promised here. And this is what they're worried about. This is what they're concerned about. You've made us a stench to Pharaoh. Yeah, God said these things, but this is what I'm experiencing. You've made us a stench. This is uncomfortable. This is not real. I haven't seen this to be real yet. And so you have these two things. You have two gods, if you will. You have the small I, small A, small M in Pharaoh, and they're worried about being a stench to him. And you have the capital I, capital A, capital M, I am. And yet, I can push that off and deal with that later. And then we find God's response to the Israelites, to Moses in chapter 6. And if this doesn't get you excited, if this doesn't help you get into perspective as to who this God is, I'm not sure what will. You might want to check your pulse, okay? So Exodus chapter 5, verse 22, and we go on to 6. Moses returned to the Lord and said, Oh Lord, what have you brought? Why have you brought trouble upon this people? Okay, this has just gotten bad. You sent me here to redeem them. Why did you bring such trouble on them if that's really your purpose? Ever since I went to Pharaoh to speak your name, he has brought trouble upon this people, and you have not rescued your people at all. You've done nothing. Okay, yep, you gave me that whole trick with that stick thing and that snake. That was pretty awesome, but it really didn't do much. Okay, in fact, it's made things worse. So I wish you hadn't even sent me. Then the Lord said to Moses, Now you will see what I will do to Pharaoh. Because of my might, my mighty hand, he will let them go. Because of my mighty hand, he will drive them out of his country. Do you see that? Not only is he going to let them go, Pharaoh's actually going to push them out. He's going to not, go. He's going to get out of here. And there's a difference. And God's going to be bringing that in. God's doing it, not Pharaoh. Okay, you go on the way, who's the God, the little I, little A, little M, or the capital I, capital A, capital M? There's a big difference. And watch what this capital I, capital A, capital M does. God said to Moses, I am the Lord. I appeared to Abraham, to Isaac, and to Jacob as God Almighty, but my name, the Lord, I did not make myself known to them. Okay, yeah, he spoke to them. But in other words, what he's saying is they haven't seen anything comparative to what I'm about to do now. You thought Abraham knew me? You thought Isaac knew me? You thought Jacob knew me? You thought Joseph knew me? Watch this. This is the time in a movie where that music starts and the hero enters, you know, and like everyone is destroyed and it's just like, wow, I want to see that part again. Okay? This is, in a sense, that moment of building right now where God is basically saying, this is who I am. You haven't seen anything. Now watch what I will do. And he lays it out here. I also established my covenant with them to give them the land of Canaan where they live, where they lied as aliens. Moreover, I have heard the groanings of the Israelites, whom the Egyptians are enslaving, and I have remembered my covenant. Therefore, say to the Israelites, I am the Lord. I will bring you out from under the yoke of the Egyptians. In other words, you're afraid of this puny god, Pharaoh. Watch what this great God is about to do. I will bring you out from under the yoke of the Egyptians. I will free you from being slaves to them, and I will redeem you with an outstretched arm and with my mighty acts of judgment. I will take you as my people, and I will be your God. Then you will know that I am the Lord your God who brought you out from under the yoke of the Egyptians, and I will bring you to the land that I swore with uplifted hand to give to Abraham, to Isaac, and to Jacob. I will give it to you as a possession. I am the Lord. Moses reported this to the Israelites, but they did not listen to him because of their discouragement and cruel bondage. Then the Lord said to Moses, go, tell Pharaoh, king of Egypt, to let the Israelites go out of his country. But Moses said to the Lord, if the Israelites will not listen to me, why would Pharaoh listen to me since I speak with faltering lips? It's fascinating. And yet the doubt exists even there with Moses. And here we have this God. I was asked this question, I don't recall if it was last week, week before. You know, in a sense, the question was kind of dealing, what's the point? You know, we're talking about all this transcendency of God, but so what? You know, yeah, that's all great. If we can't understand who this God is, if we can't internalize how he is God and how I am not, because oftentimes we live our lives in such a way where we think we lift ourselves up. Yeah, I get to make these all these decisions. I'm the one that really is the one that's important. We're totally missing it. If you can't look at these scriptures and understand this hero that steps into this picture as being the hero to worship, we need to take an honest look and say, all right, where is God in my life? What is my view of God? You know, we look at the scriptures, and oftentimes we attribute it to people that it's Moses who's the hero, or it's Abraham who's the hero, or it was Isaac or Jacob or even Joseph, the way he received his brothers back. Wow, what a hero. God's the hero. Despite what Pharaoh says, despite what Pharaoh does, despite how the Israelites accept what Moses said because they didn't believe it anyway, despite Moses' doubt doesn't change the fact that God is the hero. And he will do what he has just promised to do with the Israelites. And we're going to see that as we look through his power and the things that he brings on, these hardships and these plagues that are introduced. You see God, and he's faithful to his promises. And it doesn't matter what you think, because God is always the hero. It's not me. I'm not the hero. And it's not you. You're not the hero. Pharaoh wasn't. Even God's people are not the hero. God is the hero. And when we can see that, when we can see his transcendency, when we can see this personal nature, you know, how he interacts with Moses even on this intimate level, okay? When Moses sees God in that burning bush the first time, basically says, you're entering into my presence, take off your sandals, because where you're standing now is holy ground. This is connection time for you and I. It's so personal. We see his faithfulness, we see his goodness, we see his greatness. In Psalm 50, there's a beautiful description where God talks to his people and he says, you guys give to me sacrifices. Do I need sacrifices? You know, and he goes on to say just these bold words. He says, what do you think, I'm hungry? You know, you guys sacrifice these animals to me. What do you think I get from that? You think I'm hungry? You think I need this to, you think I get thirsty? You think your sacrifices are what sustains me? And that wasn't it. I mean, yeah, he's called for sacrifices, but those have to do with us and this relationship that we have with him. It's about a relationship. It keeps coming back to this idea of relationship. He wants the sacrifice because when we sacrifice things, we're in the Lenten season now. And I know many of us choose to give up something. That's not like, oh man, look at God, what I gave up for you. Are you so happy with me? As much as when we give up something, we connect with him in a deeper way because, Lord, I want to focus on you when I've given that up, and that might be difficult to do. You know, it's not the sacrifice that he wants. He wants us. He wants the connection. He wants the relationship. He wants us. Recently, we had a problem with our garage door. When I said we, it was me. And so, sometimes you have garage doors with springs, and the springs suddenly break. Maybe just me. I've had like four of them break, okay? I don't know what it is. I probably have something wrong. But either way, so the garage door breaks, and it's on its way down, and the spring breaks. And so what happens is the door goes like this, poosh, and it bends up. I mean, everything's just shredded. You know, so I'm standing there looking at it, like, this is a real downer, okay? And so I had to, you know, disconnect the opener, and I had to finagle it. I had to kind of jump on it, got the door closed, and then I rigged the opener so it would close the door, and it closed it and latched it, but there's the opener's just got a big bow in it with all this extra pressure. You know, I just turned up the stress on it, you know, so it'll never turn around. Anyway, so I got the door closed. Well, it was weeks later before I ever got a chance to do it, and I actually take Isaac out there, and he's going to help me. You know, Isaac's 10 years old. And there are certain pieces that he can do, and he did do. But I got to be honest, could I have done it quicker? Yeah. Could I have done it without him being injured? Yeah, because he got injured. Not seriously. He's okay. He'll live. But there was this piece to it. Why did I do it? Because I long for the relationship. I long for the connection. And that's what God wants from us. Okay, he can do our jobs way better than we can. You know what I'm saying? He can do this job that he's leading the people out of Egypt way better than Moses can. And we see that because he's the one that does it. It's his work. But he longed for that connection. He longed for that relationship with us. We're about ready to take time and reflect on this connection. And we look at Jesus and what he did. And so if the elders could come forward as we kind of prepare. The Lord has given to us this opportunity to connect with him over and over again through the gift of communion. This idea that we get to come before him, we get to take the cup and the bread, and we get to reflect on who Jesus is. Dave read the passage earlier this morning, and he referred to himself as, Jesus says, I am the bread of life. We see all of these different examples in scriptures where Jesus refers to himself as I am, I am. It says in John chapter 8, verse 58, Jesus is so bold as he tells the Pharisees, and this just gets them all riled up. He says, before Abraham was, I am. And this wasn't the little small I, small A, small M. This was the capital I, capital A, capital M. In other words, Jesus is laying it out and saying, I am God. And then he calls us into relationship with him. The night that he was about to be crucified, he was about to be betrayed, he goes before his disciples. This is the last meal that he's going to be able to have with them, and this is a very stirring and intimate time that he has. And again, you see the relationship. You see the connection. And as the meal is kind of finishing up, he takes the bread and he breaks it, and he shares it with them, and he talks about how his body is going to be broken, busted, torn apart. And then he takes the cup and he talks about this new covenant, this covenant we just talked about. This covenant with Abraham, he's bringing up a new covenant, a new promise, a promise of grace, a promise of forgiveness. And it's just amazing. And who does the work? It's him. God always does the work. I'm so thankful that he gets to use us and chooses to use us sometimes, but he's the one that does the work. If you're wondering, where am I at? I don't even know if I know Jesus. I don't know what you're talking about. This is the thing is, he does the work in us. All we have to do is say, Lord, I need you to do that work. I recognize that I can't. I work hard, but it's not by works. It's by faith. And I want to have the faith in you that you have done that work. He does the work. Because I'm so glad, because if it was up to me to do the work, I'd fix the garage door and it would break again. And it would break again. And it would break again. But when God does the work, God does the work, and it's a permanent work. It's an efficient work, and it's a good work. If you don't know what I'm kind of dealing with, you need to be praying. You need to say, Lord, I want to understand what it is, this work that you're talking about. So as we receive the elements this morning, we practice what we call open communion here. That means if you're a follower of Christ, you are welcome to participate with us. If you don't know Jesus as your Savior, Paul offers a word of caution. And he just says, this is for those who believe. This is for those who follow. And so I want you to prayerfully reflect on that as we partake together. And I ask that as you receive the bread, you take the time and you reflect on who Jesus is and what it is that he has done, the work that he has done, the work that God has done for you.